Bernard, you talked about that you made a judgment the CPRS wasn't perhaps the right thing, but the fact is because of it fell over, we've really probably lost 4 years, and in terms of what Will said, that's a hell of a lot of time. I think we need a price signal, and we need to have an international thing. We must not forget we can't do it on our own. We've got to do it, work something globally. So it almost seems to me why it was a real tragedy that we lost the CPRS. We could have had even though it was fairly imperfect, had a leadership role because we'd done something. As a middle power, we could have been out there. Now we don't have that, and we're probably looking at 4 or 5 years before we get some sort of comprehensive scheme in place.
And the question that I would get daily on air is, and John Howard used to say it all the time, why would we sign up to something when China and America and India haven't?
But again, it depends what you're signing up to. At the moment, Australia is facing real economic costs because people aren't investing either in conventional energy systems or alternative energy systems. This will lead to an increase in the cost of capital, increase in energy prices. There's a real opportunity cost. And we know that it's valuable to industries because they're paying lobbyists a fortune to intervene in the policy process. So, yeah, there are real gains from reducing the uncertainty, not eliminating uncertainty. There's no such thing as giving industry certainty. You want to give them the capacity to manage their own risks, both renewable energy investment risks and conventional energy investment risks. That's the critical point here.
Frank?
I'd just like to take up two things from your question. One is pragmatism, one is the international scene. The EU experience with emissions trading is actually very instructive. They started in phase one, back 6-7 years now, with a really messy system, right? Everyone agrees it was bad, right? But it was a start. They improved it in phase two and phase three. The way it's shaping up is really pretty good under the constraints that they have, recession going on, lobbying pressure, 27 different national governments and all the rest of it. That's really not looking too bad. And I think we need to basically not let the best be the enemy of the good here and just make a start. And that really comes back to cash for clunkers. As long as we don't have a comprehensive policy in place, like carbon pricing of any sort, really, we're going to get more of these policies, And you're going to pay $20, and you and everyone else are going to take that money and give it to someone who's quick off the mark and buy a new car, right? And not a clean new car, no, any car that's a little bit more efficient than the average that's on the road already, right? And we're going to use all that money that we've taken from you and not use it to support R&D into solar energy, into solar concentrated power, right? So if that sounds a good policy to you, go for it, And the fiscal cost of this will be $400 a tonne, when for $20 a tonne you can actually begin transformational change throughout the economy. On international, we will never be leading, right? Countries leading at the moment include China, okay? So it's very likely that China in the next few years will be implementing emissions trading, at least on a trial basis. It's very likely that China will be having province-level emissions targets for 2015. It's all manner of policies already in place to support renewable energy, to dampen energy demand in China, then we'll get to in a fair while in Australia.
I think there's a question down at the front.
Hi there. I'd like to ask about climate change, refugees, migrants, displaced persons, whatever you'd like to call them. How do you think this issue should be dealt with? Do you think that the countries that are the biggest polluters should be the ones that help pay for their resettlement?
Liz, is that you?
Yeah. This is working now?
I think if you hold it up, I think it is.
Okay. It's a great question. Thank you for that. There is no doubt that there will be large numbers of people moving and being forced to move because they're no longer be able to feed themselves and with water. Issues that will follow from that, of course, will be they'll want to move into areas where there's already problems, and so people are already feeling threatened that their quality of life is diminishing because of their own shortages. And, of course, historically speaking, if you have a look at any time throughout history, when resources become scarce, the really charming features of the human spirit come out, and, we really go in hell for leather, and there will be conflict. And so it would be very difficult to actually maintain civil society in those terms. Can we actually ignore and refuse that? I don't think anyone can. And so the moral question of do the polluters have a greater moral responsibility to take them, without doubt, will that happen is a very, very different question.
Yeah, I mean, the other... well, the reality at the moment is that Australia's policy is to just wish it wouldn't happen and hope that it all goes away. The geopolitical reality, though, is that a lot of this is going to happen in our own region, in the Pacific, which is where we have a traditional responsibility, and at some point we're going to have to deal with that. But if we're talking about things like refugees, I mean, most of the refugees will be internal. They won't be coming to Australia or New Zealand, but they'll be moving internally within their own country. That's what you tend to get with refugees. They tend to move internally rather than cross borders. So the stability issues that raises, even if you're not talking directly about large numbers of people, are going to be significant. And this traditional perception of the Pacific and the area to our north as the arc of instability, I think, which is a sort of foreign affairs term that has a lot of fans, is only going to be exacerbated by climate issues, which are already having an effect on salination of water sources in low-lying island communities, for example. I mean, these are real issues right now for people in the Pacific. And we're offering money, but I think in the hope that if we throw enough money at it, we won't actually have to deal with the long-term problems that you get with, you know, the long-term viability of some of these smaller, low-lying states.
Yes, please.
And we need to bear in mind we're not talking about the distant future here. There's currently 1.2 billion people in the world who are currently undernourished, and we could well argue that we're doing very, very little to support those people currently. So it's this is clearly going to exacerbate.
I think we've got a question over here in the red jumper.
Yep. Somebody brought up China and India, and the cost of climate change to Australia will depend very much on what the people of China and India do. At the moment, they're emitting an average of 2 tonnes per year per person, which coincidentally is what the science tells us is the sustainable level to keep the climate stable. Now, in Canberra, we are currently debating whether to have the most ambitious carbon target in Australia at about a minimum of, between about 12 and 16 tonnes per person per annum by 2020. What sort of carbon target should we be thinking of setting in order to convince the Chinese and the Indians that we're serious about climate change?
No.
Well, the Chinese and the Indians, other members of the basic group, were saying prior to Copenhagen that they expected developed countries to sign up to an aggregate target of 40%. And that's what they were saying. I doubt whether they thought that the developed countries were going to go that far, but I would be very surprised if those major developing countries would sign up to anything substantial and come good on it unless we adopted targets of about 30% as an aggregate. At the moment, we're somewhere between 10 and 14%, depending on how you move those rules I was talking about previously.
That's by 2020.
That's by 2020, yes. And really, it's the number that counts. I mean, you can talk about long-term targets till the cows come home, but everybody knows that it's the 2020, it's the near-term targets that really matter, because they're the ones that demonstrate a willingness to actually do something.
Frank Yotso and then Warwick McKibben.
Yeah, look, there's a really, really deep inequity in the whole problem. It's, first of all, it'll be mostly developing countries that suffer from impacts from climate change. And secondly, in the remaining carbon budget that we have, and we had an excellent presentation again at that conference at the ANU Climate Change Law Centre today by Mike Rohrpach, talking about how much space is there actually left to emit carbon in the atmosphere. And the developing countries today will not be able to follow the same development path as we have if we want to comply with any kind of reasonable mitigation target for the world as a whole. Okay, so there's a basic inequity. And now we've got to come to grips with that. And that will require for the rich world to do ambitious things and things that are regarded as ambitious by the poorer regions of the world. And it will require resource transfer from the rich world to the developing countries, because capital is a lot scarcer there. And in particular, public funding is a lot, lot scarcer there. And we'll need to pay for some of the action in India. China is a bit of a special situation. Given its new status as a global power, but most of the developing world will need financing from developed countries, and that's still something where we have the beginnings of something meaningful under the Copenhagen Accord, but countries need to follow through with that now.
All right, Kevin?
So if I could alienate at least 50% of the audience, let me just make the following point. There's a big difference between who should be cutting and who should be paying for the cuts. The idea that countries should all cut by the same amount and that's regarded as equivalent action is completely false. And this is where the negotiations break down. This is where the whole system has come to a grinding halt. You should be cutting where it's cheapest on the planet to cut first. And it may well be that it all occurs in a developing country. It may well be for Australia, take Australia, for example. When you model a country like Australia, which has an enormous endowment of fossil fuels, and you set a common global price, those countries that get very little output per unit of energy per unit of carbon are the ones that disappear first as emitters, and it's the Australians, unfortunately, are the ones that are left producing carbon because we are the most expensive, most efficient carbon polluters. Now, if you take that as the economic outcome of any of these systems, the critical question is, how do you transfer the resources to the low-cost actions? Why would we cut in the ACT if it turns out this is the best place on the planet to be emitting carbon? It is against the nature and laws of fundamental economics, and the system will collapse eventually if you go too much against basic economic reality. And you can laugh, but that's why we are today where we are when the Kyoto promises were made in 1997 were made. Yes, we can do this. We just violate the laws of economics. No, you can't. The bottom line will eventually dominate the policy, and you have to put that up front in the design of the global system, or you won't get anywhere no matter how well-meaning you are. And that's how we got into the problem we got today. That's the reality.
I think there's another question over this. Oh, here in the red vest.
Andrew, you suggested, if I heard right, that we could invest $100 million and buy abatement from the land sector. I'm wondering two questions on that. Who's liable if that soil carbon or carbon stored in trees is lost in a drought or bushfire? And the second question is, putting all our money into those sort of abatement options, does that not just distract us from the task of reducing our reliance on fossil fuels?
Firstly, I wasn't saying pour all your money into it. I'm saying in the interim, if we're going to spend money on interim programs, let's spend it on somewhere we can actually get some long-term and decent-sized abatement out of it. And secondly, in terms of who's liable if it turns out that, say, we plant trees or we get regrowth in an area and then they burn, and who's liable for that? Well, it depends on what scheme you're talking about, but let's just say that you converted a deforested land unit and you allowed the forest to regrow, and under Kyoto rules that'd count, and then that burnt down. Well, if provided it regrows, over the long term, you're going to get more carbon on that land unit than you otherwise would. Now, while you might have an interim loss in terms of a particular counting year, over the long term, it'll be a greater source, a greater sink than it otherwise would have been. And I think that's a good thing, even though you might have, you know, particular years where it's less than it might have been.
I'll make a comment on
that. Sure, we'll
scientifically, there's actually a difference between the two, fossil fuel, carbon, and carbon in landscape. Carbon in landscape is part of the active biological cycle, which goes between atmosphere, land, and sea all the time. Fossil carbon is quite different scientifically. It's locked away from that cycle, and by accessing it and burning it, we're throwing it into that cycle. You can never offset fossil carbon long-term by trying to put it in the land. The only thing you can do is replace the legacy carbon that's come from past deforestation. And as you pointed out, there's some real vulnerabilities with that carbon. Let me play the scenario out, which may very well happen, as countries decide they're going to try to offset for the next decade or two by shoving carbon into the landscape. Two huge, huge problems with that. One is they would be tempted to delay action to transform their energy systems, locking in more fossil fuel-intensive carbon-emitting systems. Second of all, though, temperature will rise and continue to rise because the big-ticket item isn't the emissions from deforestation. That's only 15% now. 85% is fossil fuel. Temperature will continue to rise, and it will lead to vulnerability of that carbon you've just stored, vulnerability of more carbon you've just shoved into the landscape, which will then reappear in the atmosphere and accelerate the warming. There's a real trap with offsetting in landscapes. I'm not saying you shouldn't put carbon in landscapes. There's a lot of good reasons for doing it, but don't do it as an offset for reducing fossil fuel emissions. The science is absolutely clear on that point.
Now, I think we've got a question up here.
This is probably addressed to the economist and the lawyer, Andrew Frank and Warwick. If you believe apparently well-informed political commentators like Lenore Taylor from the Sydney Morning Herald, a key part of the then kitchen cabinet made up of Tanner Swad, Gillard and Rubbs' decision to defer the ETS was a fear that in people's minds the current steeply increasing electricity prices right around Australia would be confused with the emissions price. And if that's true, it probably means that it would be a bit like trying to bring in the GST when the second oil price shock was happening. In as much as those price increases are largely due to a backlog of distribution and transmission investment. They're not due at all, as we all know, to emissions trading, which hasn't started. So if all that is true, what do you think of an idea of requiring electricity retailers to separately list on their electricity bill the real cost of carbon to consumers, rather than allowing them to think that the whole increase is just because of carbon trading? Because I fear that a lot of people think they're already paying for carbon trading.
First best here is to actually make it so that the rights to emit are held by the consumers themselves, and they sell those rights to industry that needs to abate, and there you get a revenue transfer which is far larger than the increase in the cost of your electricity. So you as a consumer, by knowing how the system works, you're better off financially. How can that be? In my system, I want to take the next 100 years' worth of rights and give them to the current generation, let them sell these rights in a market and get lots of compensation for the increases in prices, which are inevitable. I think it's a furphy to try and explain to people that a great big tax is a bad thing. It's only a bad thing because the revenue is disappearing somewhere down a black hole. It's a really good thing if the revenue goes into your bank account and you're getting more from the revenue than you're paying in higher prices. To me, making that direct link is a key part of the politics of this. And this comes back to the question from the gentleman in the green sweater. If the government had given the property rights to carbon to 50% of the rights to all of the population, how could you not win an election by giving that enormous compensation bundle to voters as compensation for future energy prices over the next 100 years of their life?
Who gets what rights?
It's quite easy. Every person who's alive gets a fixed share of the rights. You're not doing income redistribution in my policy. You're just compensating uniformly. You can have other policies that redistribute income. Do them through
a farmer gets the same amount as someone living in a city. Is that right?
Well, you could divide it up into different... If a farmer is a producer as well as a consumer, then you'd make a different allocation. But generally, the issue here is you've got far more to redistribute if you make these very long-term rights than if you just make them a one-year right to emit. And that's the problem with the dilemma they face with the argy-bargy over compensation, is they're only compensating producers with five-year permits. If you could compensate with 100-year permits, there's more money to slosh around because you're stealing from future generations their right to emit and you're giving it to the current generation in return for a better climate in the future. That's a real honest trade-off that the politicians should be prepared to make.
If this played out as a national security issue, could it ever play out as that?
Quite easily be a national security issue.
And then, I'll go to Bernard perhaps in this, are you more likely to get bipartisan support?
Look, this exchange has just summed up one of the key problems we've had, which is politicians who, for whatever reason, are unable to sell the simplest policies. If they couldn't sell something like the RSPT, the CPRS was, and of course they're obsessed with having four-letter acronyms, but the task of selling that scheme, and I agree with Warwick that it's not necessary that people understood it in detail, and people didn't understand it in detail, but this comes back to a basic inability, I think, of politicians to actually sell anything, virtually anything. I was going to say anything more complicated than most basic policies. Sell them and then defend them against the attacks of vested interests and rent seekers. The benefits of an emissions trading scheme are, of course, are diffuse and they're long term, and most of the beneficiaries have not even been born. The losers are all around about now, and they're well organised, they're well resourced, and they're well connected. Now, previous generations of politicians have found a way to actually negotiate those traps and actually put in place good economic policy. For whatever reason, it seems that the current generation of politicians have lost that capacity. So the only thing that worries me about Warwick Scheme is that it would require a politician with basic selling skills to actually mount it. And I'm really not sure that we have those at the moment.
I'll go up the back. I think there's a question up the back here.
Oh, hi there. Do you think
just get the microphone quite close so we can
hear
you.
Is it better?
That's better.
Okay.
Thank you.
This is a question. Do you think climate change is a symptom of modern society? I mean, people had countries, had wars, modern industry, and they're causing environmental pollution. And now, since we're in a relatively peaceful stage, which is like built on economic targets and being mutually cooperative, do we need to enter another stage? And if so, what do we need to for the mass society, for the masses in society? And if so, what do we need to do?
So you're saying there's a lack of urgency because?
I just can't
quite hear you. I'm sorry.
Okay, my issue is just basically, what do we need to enter another stage, another phase in modern society where people need to change a lot? And if so, what are these major changes?
Did any of the panel want to?
I'm not sure. I think we've got the tools to address the problem. I don't think we need a revolutionary change. I think we've got this tool set to actually deal with this issue. I'm not convinced that it requires some sort of fundamental overturning. Well, having just said we haven't got any politicians to actually do this, but we've got the toolkit to actually do it. It's not as though this is a policy problem that is beyond the wit of people of goodwill to actually resolve. So I'm not convinced that somehow we need to overturn everything in order to actually reduce carbon emissions.
Again, it gets back to something that quite a few of us have toyed with, and that's, you know, wherein lies the resistance to actually make the change. And we often hear the argument that, of course, when during the war, with the war effort, people were quite happy to forego their personal, you know, their financial well-being, etc., and they were quite happy to go forward and give up things for the common good. What we're wanting is people have been frightened by the fact that it's going to be so austere and horrible, but I mean that there does need to be an attitudinal change, and how we actually collectively, and this is globally collectively, make that shift from everything I can now and you know, continued growth is the only thing that's important to us, to the fact that, well, you know, there are many other things that are valuable in life, and again, sort of logically, people realise that the true things that people really value and not the economic things, and it's not stuff, and it's not all that business. And it's at what point we can get back and start thinking that. We don't want to have to actually go onto this, for it to be legislated and hard and for the world war footing to be able to make those sacrifices, just moving on to appreciating that what we really value in life, which is families and love and food and all those nice things.
Frank, you're so, and we're coming to the end. We're coming up to 7 o'clock, and it's a Monday night. But if you do want to ask a question, please put your hand up, and then we'll bring it to an end. But Frank,
and I agree wholeheartedly with that. But I'd like to add that you don't even need to take it out of the realm of the economic and materialistic. We just need to keep reminding ourselves that what we're risking here is really the future economic welfare of our societies, right? And Australia, it's not just the economic impacts that on the bad end of things we're facing in Australia, it's also the bad end scenarios in our neighbours. You know, we do rely in this country on trade relationships with other economies for our own welfare. And we're putting all that on the line collectively as a global society if we don't tackle the problem. And how do you translate that into domestic policy action is really the crucial thing. And if you want to get anywhere at all, you will need political leadership on the issue. And you cannot have, you know, politics kind of like a weather vane, kind of, you know, sounding out what the latest fad is in the electorate.
You need a vision
to be put before the people. And some leadership and some trying it out and starting down that.
But it's harder than that, Frank. You not only need political leadership today, if you don't design the system properly, you have to come up with a political leader every single generation into the future. The chances that we can do that as a country and not fall into what we've just seen in this election is pretty close to zero. So whoever has the political commitment should lock it in through the economic system, through long-term property rights, and then people react to the bottom line. As well-meaning as some people want them to be, you've got to get them at the bottom line, and you've got to make everyone believe it's their own self-interest to move forward in this direction. And then you only need one political leader, and that's right now, to lock this system in place.
Okay.
Yes. On one last thing, people didn't think that we'd give up slavery or smoking or.
But it took the scientists 20 years to prove.
Oh, certainly it takes a long time. But I mean, there are some very strange things that people thought was fundamental parts of life that we quite happily.
The slavery, most of the studies on slavery have discovered that it was the economic costs of slaves which ended up destroying that industry, not the moral objectives of a small group in society. There's a lot of literature on that, and it was too expensive to ship these people halfway around the world, and that's why slavery died. It's also the reason we stopped killing whales for whale oil, was because we discovered an alternative, which was fossil fuels. And so,
what about CFCs?
Yeah, we have a lot. That's fine. That's because you priced it properly.
Well, also because the cost was so much smaller. You know, CFCs are not the same as thing as CO2. That's right. It's a political issue, unfortunately. And I agree with Bernard. It's primarily a political issue, and unfortunately, it looks at this point in time, there's a real risk that we're going to go to the wall on this issue, having all the tools.
Well, and that was my question about if it's agreed that this is a national security issue, if it's sold as that, is that the one time
but
you can get bipartisanship?
It's not a national security issue. We don't incur the cost right away, but we incur the cost in the future, and that's
don't
the problem.
Sell this, we don't sell this to people. This sounds like the political debates we're seeing in Australian society today. It's not the selling, it's the realisation and bringing to the fore a policy that will actually do what we need it to do. The idea that we have to sell it, I think, is problematic, because then you'll get the sort of policies that we're seeing right now, a sell policy which is not based on something sound. We need a sound, credible framework. We don't have that from either side of politics.
And yet in the media, you're required to balance, and that particularly here at the public broadcaster, I'm required to provide balance. So this is where I suppose that point becomes problematic. I would be required to put someone who would argue against the science on and give them the same time.
Balance is sort of misreporting the. I think might be one of yours, Will. The misreporting the football score, if it was 99.
That's the analogy I used. You need balance in reporting a soccer match. And you say the balance is, it's a very close match. It's going to go to penalty shootout. We don't know who's going to win. You have to balance it. When someone asks what the score is, it's 99-1. You know, is this balance? You know, is this the sort of balance we need?
I just raised that point.
The problem the ABC's got, and I'm always accusing the ABC of balance without judgment, is that when it seeks to balance something, the people it goes to for the balance aren't equipped to actually provide it. This might get me lynched, but there are somewhat credible climate skeptics out there who question various aspects of the anthropogenic global warming hypothesis, who may not be complete skeptics but do raise significant issues about it. They seem to never be heard from, but you get the Chris Monktons of the world getting free run on the ABC. Now that's what I mean by when I talk about balance without judgment. It's fulfilling those editorial guidelines, and you're required to do it, but actually doing it in a way that serves the interests of the listener or the viewer, and I'm not sure, or the reader as it is now.
But again, you don't have to believe in the science to know that there's an economic case to take action, because we're risking the next 20 or 30 years' worth of energy system development in this country by doing nothing. So even if you're a total sceptic, a do-nothing option, as long as you control the costs, is actually a good strategy. So the sceptics should come up on board immediately under the system that I'm advocating, because at least I'm controlling the costs.
But still someone's going to have to sell it. You know, someone's going to have to sell it, say, just at the moment. Someone's going to have to sell it to the Greens to get it through. In order to sell it to the Greens, you're going to have to give them some way of selling it to the community. There's always a selling element in this.
And that's my point about
the
media too.
That's one of the great challenges that have to be overcome. I think, as we've discussed, I think there's a lot of positives in the scheme that you propose. But at the moment, one of the great challenges is being able to sell that to people. And I don't have any great solutions. I'm not a marketer.
Well, just one more question. I think we better wrap it. Yep.
Why do you think, if there's other ideas which would be doing more for the environment and would be more economically feasible, why wouldn't they sell just as well for the electorate? Why wouldn't they?
Have a look at all the policies we've done thus far and where we're focusing all the attention. It's on the household sector. Household sector, why? It's because we live there. You know, we can chuck money at PVs because we can put them on our houses. Everybody, well, a large proportion of the population drives a car. So what does the government do? It looks at ways to give you subsidies for cars. You know, that's why in the household sector represents, what is it, 10% of Australia's emissions? You know, there's still 90%. Why are we not concentrating on the other areas? It's because they can give you policies to throw money at you and do pork barrelling, in my opinion.